Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, most merciful, most kind. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Peace and blessings be upon you. Welcome to the program tonight. Before we start, I'm going to ask Sheikh Uwais Tarapuri to recite some verses from the Holy Quran, and then we'll get the meeting underway, inshallah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم القارعة ما القارعة وما أدراك ما القارعة يوم يكون الناس كالفراش المبثوث وتكون الجبال كالعهن المنفوش القارعة ما القارعة وما أدراك ما القارعة يوم يكون الناس كالفراش المبثوث وتكون الجبال كالعهن المنفوش فأما من ثقلت موازينه فهو في عيشة راضية وأما من خفت موازينه فأمه هاوية وما أدراك ما هي نار حامية صدق الله العظيم.
ما شاء الله. جزاك الله خير. Thank you very much to Sheikh Uwais Tarapuri. Okay. I'm not accustomed to talking in public, not on my home patch too much anyway, but it's a great pleasure for me to be able to be here tonight at this gathering, and I've decided to call it, as chair, I'm using my prerogative to call it the Gathering in Appreciation of George Galloway, GAG for short. Now, that's highly appropriate. So I spent all day thinking about it. Because, George, I've had the pleasure and the honour of sharing a platform with him on a number of occasions over the last 2 years. And has always waited for this opportunity to be able to say something about him in appreciation. I first heard the name George Galloway when he probably had his first national disagreement with the media in his days as General Secretary of War on Want, when the sobriquet Gorgeous George was coined. And it's been like that ever since, because George is one of those rare things that I have come across, is a politician who stands up for what is right, whether or not it's hurt him personally or politically. And clearly at the moment, what he has been standing up for is and may well hurt him even more politically. But I know he's taking great support and great strength from gatherings like this around the country, where ordinary people, people who have no great political aspirations, are coming out in support of not only George, but of what he stands for. If you do a search on the website, on the internet, George Galloway, you get 17,400 sites to go through. So he's marginally famous, more famous than Ismail. Marginally. And George, ever since he's been elected to Parliament in 1987 in Glasgow, has been known as a maverick. Now, when I was a boy, Maverick was quite a cool television series. It was quite good to be a maverick. But apparently it's not anymore, because you're not supposed to speak out. And in a democracy, when you have the situation with a government with a massive majority, a very weak, compliant opposition, the voice that speaks out has to be supported. Because unless there is opposition, I believe there is no democracy. You get a one-party state, and things can be done against the will of the people. So it's refreshing when someone like George comes along and is prepared to put his reputation on the line in many senses, because we all know that if the powers that be want to stop anybody speaking out, then it's not only their political, professional life which comes under the microscope, but they will try and dig up anything and everything in the personal life to try and destroy someone's reputation. And we know what's happened recently in the efforts to try and gag George in his opposition to the war in Iraq, to try and gag him for his strong support for the people of Palestine in their continuing struggle against the illegal occupation of their land, and to continue to try and gag him from speaking out in support of social justice, wherever and whoever that might be affecting. These efforts to gag him are very serious indeed, and require us to speak up and speak out on his behalf, and to show that yes, he's one man, but he's not alone. That each and every one of us, whether we agree with George on every issue or not, support him in this. And I think it would be very boring if we did agree with George on everything. We don't. I don't. But that's what a democracy is all about. And it's the valuing the fact that we can sit and discuss things in an open and honest way, that we value this sort of democratic process. And that even if someone has points of view which are vastly different to ours, we can still sit with them, talk with them, be friends with them, and support them in times of need like this. And I want to welcome you all. I was asking George just outside about the audience, and he said, well, we'll expect midweek Leicester, quite a good turnout. And I can tell you now, he's just told me, this is fantastic. He appreciates the turnout already, and we haven't even got going yet. There's still people coming in, alhamdulillah. So to thank you all, Jazakallah khair, for coming out. We have a number of speakers this evening. We've got the media here this evening, and it's nice to see the media on a Friends of Al-Aqsa organized program, because we don't always get media coverage. We're not all Muslims here. Again, it's an opportunity to show that the people of Leicester, this is George's first visit to Leicester, and I hope, inshallah, God willing, it won't be his last. And I think if we can show him tonight that the people of Leicester mean business when they mean business, then it won't be his last. We will see him back here again, if only to have another meal of Zaytun. We got the doggy bags as well. Okay. The first speaker, I'd like to introduce, some of us may not know of him, most of us do know him, it's Sheikh Ibrahim Moga, who's chair of the Imams Committee for the Muslim Council of Britain, and is one of our Imams here in Leicester, who's going to speak for 5 or 6 minutes, Moulana. It's one chance I will have to actually pull the plug on that. No, I won't pull the plug on that. Bismillah. Sheikh Ibrahim.
Bismillah wa salam ala rasulillah wa sayyidi al-anbiya. Ladies and gentlemen, I feel very honored and it gives me great pleasure to express our appreciation for George and the tremendous amount of work that he has carried out on to express our thanks on all your behalf. George, we've heard stories about you. Your reputation precedes you, with particular reference to one of the broadsheet newspapers. But let me remind you of what the Muslim attitude has been towards that, or what the principles of the Quran and what Islam teaches about any news that one receives. The Quran says that if a rebellious type of source gives you any information, then you have to verify it, you have to check it out. In case you harm and you hurt others out of your ignorance of the facts of the matter. The fact that you have been accused, or people have said things about you, and that case is well known to the community, has not in the least diminished our confidence in your work that you have done over the past years for human rights, for the rights of people who have no voice. The Quran encourages us, in particular as Muslims, and indeed all of humankind, to stand for justice. And God addresses us to say, you must stand for justice even if it is against your own people. And George, I think you have done that. You stood up to your colleagues when you needed to. You did not worry about the consequences of your stance. All that was on your mind was justice, to speak against the injustice, against the oppressed peoples of the world. And it gives us great pleasure to know that a lot of the causes that you have championed have been in the favor of our fellow Muslim brethren around the world. Not that those are the only communities that you have stood up for. So that doubly makes us want to express our appreciation this evening to you for the tremendous amount of work that you've done. Not only that, the messenger, Muhammad, peace be on him, said, out of all the different categories of jihad, jihad is a term that is well known to the wider community, but perhaps for all the wrong reasons. But the messenger said that the best of jihad is that of an individual who stands up for truth and justice in the face of tyrant rulers, or a tyrant ruler. George, you have done that. And we regard you as a great mujahid. George, when I was introduced to you earlier on, we had a little chat, albeit very brief, in Arabic. I've shown you how you have fulfilled the principles of the Quran when it comes to standing up for justice, how you have fulfilled the principles that the Messenger set down of being a great mujahid. I'm just wondering, how come you're not a Muslim? Well, I had a little chat with my friend and colleague, Reverend Alan Race. George, this is something that I think I should tell you before you go, otherwise it will be backbiting, according to Muslim principles. But I asked Reverend Race there, I said, is George fair game? He said, what? And I said, is George amongst those who have been reached? But coming back to on a more serious note, George, you are a brother to us, and anyone who stands up for the rights of fellow human beings is a brother, and we embrace them regardless of their faith, whether they have a faith or not. They are our brothers in humanity, and we appreciate all the hard work that you put in to bring about justice and understanding for the troubled people of the world. So on behalf of all those that are gathered here, you can see, George, that it's not just Muslims, but the whole multicultural, multi-faith Leicester is here today, or a sizable representation of our city is here today to express their gratitude and their thanks to you. So George, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sheikh Mogher. It's always embarrassing when we have to introduce someone and I don't know the full name. But I have heard the next speaker in action, and she's impressive. And she's impressive for another reason, because she's been working very actively on a cause close to my heart for many years, Palestine. She's head of the Palestinian Solidarity Committee here in Leicester. I'd like to ask Jane if she'd like to come and say a few words.
Right, I have to confess this has been sprung upon me at the last moment, so I'm not going to stay up here for a long time. What I'd like to do is just tell you, I first became aware of George Galloway when he was instrumental in the twinning of Nablus and Dundee. I think I'm right in saying that. And I was in Palestine at the time, and I can tell you that the atmosphere created by that event was absolutely fantastic, and he was really a hero in Nablus, and I hope in Dundee as well. Everybody had little badges. I think I still may have one, Nablus Dundee. So that was back in, I can't remember, 1980. Yeah, so that's a long time ago. And George Galloway has always worked very, very, very hard on behalf of the Palestinians, as I think anybody who's interested in human rights and justice should be doing. I'd like to add to what's already been said about his courage in standing up to a vicious onslaught from the establishment and from the Labour establishment as well, and I think really they should be ashamed of themselves. I think everybody here will support him, and I think everybody should support him in this. I really don't want to say much more, except we're very pleased in the Leicester Palestine Solidarity Campaign to welcome George here tonight, and also I'd like to thank the Friends of Al-Aqsa for organising this meeting, which is absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. Okay. Next speaker has already had a mention. It's the Reverend Alan Race, who's member of the Leicester Council of Faiths and is vicar at Aylstone Church here in Leicester. So, Alan, please.
You in such a wonderful gathering. And I'm pleased also to add my own appreciation of the work of George Galloway, particularly though I think certainly from my point of view in relation to the whole Iraq issue. I remember for a long time myself and two colleagues travelling down on one of the Muslim coaches for, you know, that great march in London. But I was asked really just to say a few words this evening, perhaps a little bit tangential to the main cause and the main purpose, but I think of it like this, just to set the business of the appreciation, particularly of the work of George, but the work itself for human rights, for justice, for peace, for solidarity in a great number of causes. Try and set that in a broader context, particularly in relation to a multi-faith world. We have a multi-faith city here, but part obviously of a multi-faith world. And I begin, it'll be very brief here, okay. I begin with my little story of, I think, one of the most significant encounters of my life. And this was a few years ago in South Africa, in Cape Town, where I was attending a large conference, a multi-faith conference. I'd been to Robben Island and visited Nelson Mandela's cell. I'd seen the concrete yard where he sat for years and years in the blazing sun, just smashing up rocks for no reason at all. But was not prepared for the electrifying encounter with him in his speech in the main conference. Here was someone who carried really the moral authority of suffering for right, for justice, before him. And it was quite obvious in his speech and in his presentation, in his manner. But what was significant was that in the middle of that speech, a kind of prepared speech that people have at conferences, he broke off for an aside which said, "You know, I would not have survived my years in imprisonment had it not been for the religious vision that was given to me at my mother's knee." For him, it happened to be a Christian one, but he was quite clear it was a vision about basic humanity and basic solidarity, basic rights, basic peace, basic harmony between peoples that could be shared across cultures, across nations, across religions. And I took heart from that, that it was a right thing to do now and a proper thing to do in a multi-faith world to actually point out that religious vision has resources and resourcefulness for a different kind of world than we have now. To be sure, religion is sometimes part of the problem, but actually that is often the abuse of religion, as we know. But we can only make that clear if we join together across different barriers, different communities, different understandings, in a cause which is greater than all of us. I think none of us now can say we live in a world in which, as it were, simply the way we think for ourselves is sufficient for all. There is a journey to be undertaken to build up the whole movement of friendship, of solidarity, of dialogue, we say, in a technical kind of, using a technical kind of word in the interreligious movement, to build up a momentum for change which is based on the values of compassion and peace and justice and so on. So I was thinking about this, I took down from my shelf, because I'm like that, a book which has the title Faith in Human Rights, and the subtitle, I'm reading it here, Support in Religious Traditions for Global Struggle. And one conclusion of that study is that the religions and human movements across the world don't agree about, we know this, about the theoretical basis for things like human rights, but they do agree that there is a practical task to undertake which they can all share. And as I was perusing through, I came across some words from another visionary in that book. I'm just going to reach down now and get it. Thank you. And I'll end with them. They're words from Martin Luther King, who said these words when he received the Nobel Peace Prize. "We must proclaim," he says, "an audacious faith," and I quote here, "that peoples everywhere can have three meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality and freedom for their spirits." I think all of us would say yes to that. I think that's been part of George Galloway's journey as well. So we applaud it. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Alan Reeves. Our next speaker is well known to most of us here. It's Brother Abdul Karim Giwala. I don't know which hat you're wearing tonight, Abdul Karim. Right? Indian Muslim Federation, Islamic Education, general all-round concern for the state of humanity. So, Brother Abdul Karim Giwala.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to take much longer, as I don't think it's very appropriate for me to be between you and the special guest who we would all like to hear. But I think I've been asked to actually say a few words, and I would say that I would echo the same sentiments that the other speakers have expressed so far, starting from Sheikh Mogra, ending with a leadership from Christian community. I would have thought that all of us agree that dignity, equality, justice, these are all noble principles, philosophies, concepts, advocated, supported, promoted, advanced by all the major religions. And I don't see any reason, not even for a second, to say that even those people who do not have any religion would have any objection to some of these noble principles. Well, if that is the case, then what George is doing needs to be appreciated by all of us. And I think this event this evening is very clearly demonstrating that a sizable, multicultural, multi-faith Leicester community has gathered to appreciate what George is doing, not only for the Muslims in Palestine, not only for those who have been oppressed throughout the world. His concern crosses the boundaries of religion. His concerns crosses the boundaries of race. He comes out of those narrow thinking and takes a much more wider view and tries to do something for the oppressed, for the people who are continuously suffering, for the people who have got no voice. I have absolutely no doubt and no reservation to say that people who are engaged in such kind of noble efforts will not only be rewarded in this world, but will also be rewarded in the hereafter. George, while I know that you've been quite actively involved with Palestinian Muslims and your opposition to Iraq war is quite well known, from a very brief encounter that I had over the meal with George, and you did agree that not many people are involved or are aware of what's happening to Muslims in Gujarat in particular and Muslims in India in general, I would only request on behalf of the large Indian Muslim community of Leicester that you will do your best to highlight the plight of the sufferers of communal riots, the victims of communal riots in Gujarat, and will do your best to publicize the plight of Indian Muslims. On behalf of the community, on behalf of all of us, we thank you for accepting our invitation to be with us this evening. We thank you for visiting Leicester. We thank you and appreciate greatly and admire greatly the efforts and the work that you have been involved in. And we wish and we sincerely pray that you will succeed in your efforts, not only succeed in your efforts, but you will continue your efforts with more commitment, zeal and dedication, no matter what happens and what Labour Party decides about your future. Thank you.
Jazakallah khair. Abdul Karim Diwala. Okay. The next speaker doesn't really need an introduction, so I'm not going to give him one. I've always wanted to say that as well. Ismail Patel is the organizer of this meeting tonight. Friends of Al-Aqsa has done an incredible amount of work to raise awareness of the plight of the Palestinians and catapulted Ismail from being an optician here in Leicester to international superstar status and what have you. So, Ismail Patel.
Yeah.
I'll get my glasses next to you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah wa kafa wa salamun ala ibadihi allazina istafa'a ma ba'd. Ba'ud billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Subhanallazi asra bi'abdihi laylan minal masjid al-harami ilal masjid al-aqsa allazi barakna hawlahu. My dear respected and honorable friend, George, ulamas, elders, brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It is an immense pleasure, an honor, and gratifying to be in the company of the right honorable gentleman of Kelvin Glasgow. He's not right honourable because he's an MP. He's not right honourable because he stands for the Labour Party. He's not right honourable because he's in the House of Commons. Oh no. He is right honourable because he has a moral authority. A moral authority that he says that he represents the oppressed of this world. When the oppressed of Kashmir were languishing in their gullies, it was George Galloway who cried for them in Trafalgar Square. When the black South Africans were being butchered in 1976, the Lanager Saville massacre, it was George Galloway who was moving with the ANC in London and promoting them. When the Palestinians were and are being killed, George Galloway is the man who is standing up against the grain of the power of the world. And when this mighty power decided to impose sanctions on the innocent people of Iraq, it was George Galloway on his double-decker bus traveled from London all the way to Iraq to show the world what the innocent Iraqis were suffering. And we, George, are grateful and honourable for that. George and I go back a few years. And I'll tell you a little story. When I first met George, I asked for a campaign against the Byzantine Empire in the Syrian province. What did Amr say? Amr replied on the same letter. He stated, "I am but an arrow in the quiver of Islam. You, Abu Bakr, are the archer. Pick up the fittest shaft and aim it against those who are trying to destroy Islam." This is what George nearly told me and said, "Ismail, take me whenever you want to. I am ready to do that work for you." And when we went to South Africa, the impact we made was amazing. It was phenomenal, and this is not an exaggeration. It was phenomenal not because I had an MP from London. No, it was phenomenal because I had somebody who the South Africans had respect for and came with a moral authority because he had been in the forefront against the apartheid brutal regime of South Africa. So when he talked about Palestine and apartheid in Palestine, they could relate to it and understand what this man is talking about. And we transformed the South African government's thinking. a government that believed in the Oslo process, to a government after 1 week stay that publicly stated, the ministers in the ANC government stated, that Oslo is a dead process and only a single state solution of Palestine will work. George, we are greatly honored that you have been with us. You have enriched our movements. You have given support to the weakest of this world. And for that, I am sure you will be rewarded abundantly, more than any words or deeds can do for you here. And if the Labour Party so wishes, that George is too big for the Labour Party, then I tell you what, Leicester will have you here, and we will send you as an MP to stand for Leicester. George, we are honored to be in your company. And thank you for accepting our invite. Thank you very much, George.
Brothers and sisters, friends, George Galloway.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Mr. Chairman, distinguished elders, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, wassalamu alaikum. Peace be with you. It's almost unbearable to hear what has been said tonight. I have to tell you, it's touched me to the bottom of my heart, and I will forever be grateful to you. These have been difficult days for me, as you all know, and I do indeed draw great strength from rallies such as this. You know, I was just thinking, listening to the speeches, that when Harold Wilson, the then British Prime Minister, was alive, Private Eye magazine got a hold of his Times obituary being kept in readiness for his death. And when Private Eye published it, the shock nearly killed him. It's been a little like this evening. I felt I was... Well, you get my drift. I don't have to develop the point and tempt fate. But really, it touched on so many aspects of my life, in some cases unwittingly. The Reverend didn't know me and didn't know of my work in South Africa. I didn't know that Jane was going to be speaking, of that she had been in Nablus in 1980 when we twinned the city of Dundee with Nablus, and our city hall became the first public building in the Western world to fly the Palestinian flag from its flagstaff 23 years ago. As Ismail, my dear brother, discovered when he took me to South Africa, I had some form there. And the Reverend mentioned Nelson Mandela. In fact, I was one of the very few people, because of my work with the ANC, who was able to go to South Africa during the apartheid period undercover on behalf of the ANC. And I came within 5 yards of tricking my way into Nelson Mandela's hospital room in Paul's Moor Hospital in Johannesburg, wearing a white coat and with a stethoscope around my neck. You'll read about it in my memoirs. And we were rumbled and chased into the Gugulethu township in Johannesburg, where we were finally captured by several police vehicles and policemen with machine guns and taken in an armored personnel carrier to the Guguletu police station, where I was interrogated rather roughly by a policeman by the name of Campbell. And I've hated the name unaccountably ever since. And of course, the reference made to Kashmir is also very important and very close to my heart, because very few others seem to care or know. There's something about Muslim blood in the world that it can be spilt cheaply. The value of Muslim lives is not the same as the value of the lives of others. 650,000 Indian soldiers occupy Kashmir. It's the most densely populated concentration of military force in the entire world. There has been an intifada raging for 15 years in which almost 100,000 martyrs have fallen. The dungeons are dark and deep and filled with the mujahid and their supporters, and nobody cares. And so when I took up my sword on this question, I expected to make many enemies, as I did on many of these other struggles. But however many enemies there are, and however rich and powerful they are, in the end, we are many and they are few. And we have a saying in the Scottish Labour movement that the great only appear to be great as long as the rest of us are on our knees. When we rise, they're not so great. And they're not greater than God. And they're not greater than the people. Now, I'm in the British Parliament with a close-up view of the disaster which is unfolding for Mr. Blair's government. If you look at Tony Blair, and you look at the spring in my step, if you look at the length of his face, if you look at the Shakespearean way in which all this tragedy is now engraved upon his face, you wonder who won the war, him or us. But yeah. Well, funnily enough, I was coming to just that point. I was just going to say that the Conservatives have made a very big mistake with this advertisement that they have put out, which shows Mr. Blair as Pinocchio with his nose growing longer with every lie. In fact, I sit very close to him in the Parliament. I sit on what is known as the Tribune Bench, which is on the front bench but below the gangway, which places me some 5 yards from him in the chamber, and I can honestly tell you that his nose doesn't grow when he lies. You only know that he's lying because his lips are moving. And his brass neck doesn't blush. Doesn't blush. But the key point is that it will never be glad, confident morning again for him. You know, someone said yesterday, Alice Mahan, in fact, my parliamentary colleague, at a press conference we did, that the trust between a doctor and a patient is a very precious and fragile thing. But once it's lost forever. And Mr. Blair has lost the trust of the British people who now know him. They now know him to be a liar and a deceiver, and nothing that he ever says again will be able to be taken at face value. And that's why I say, and I've been saying it now for some weeks, that this is Mr. Blair's Watergate. And it will end in the same way as the original Watergate, with the departure of the liar from the political stage. And the sooner the better. Now, my brother Ibrahim, in introducing me, used the dreaded M word, Maverick. Because I'm the same age as him, I too used to watch the rather cool character who was then called Maverick, and I never dreamt that one day they would say it about me, still more that they would say it in an insulting way. But I've taken the trouble to look up the dictionary definition of Maverick, which means an unbranded beast. It's an unbranded beast, a cattle, a head of cattle without a proprietor. Well, I'm content with that description. I'm not owned by anyone, not paid by anyone, not paid by anyone. And I'm not answerable to anything except my conscience and God. And I have followed this path and this policy in all of my political work, and I think that it's the only proper way to operate. On the subject of farmyard animals, though, I have seen rather a large number of sheep in the parliamentary system over these last years. Going like sheep, not to their own slaughter, but to vote for the slaughter of others. And this is simply unforgivable. And you have many of them in this region. And they have to answer to you. Every 4 years, they have to answer to you. And I hope that you will be rigorous in your consideration of those politicians who so badly let down the British people when they went like sheep into the voting lobbies to vote for the catastrophe that is now unfolding in Iraq. I stand there. I can't sit because I'm currently suspended, and I don't want to sit on that side with the Conservatives, and I'm not allowed to sit on this side with my own colleagues. So I stand. And I look at the green benches. Sometimes I see a shiver running along, looking for a spine to run up. But there are real exceptions. We have many fine colleagues in the House of Commons, many of whom are now finding their voice and their strength to fight back. And you saw what happened in the House of Commons yesterday, when yet another of these Blairite free market fantasies was foisted upon the Parliament. Another huge rebellion took place, and the government's huge majority of 174 was massively reduced. And this will begin to happen more and more. And you can encourage that. You should encourage your Member of Parliament to stand up for the right thing and to stop behaving like sheep. And if they feel that you're doing that, if they feel the pressure from their constituencies, then they will be braver and bolder, and Mr. Blair's demise will come all the quicker. I want, if I may, to spend a few minutes talking about the two most important subjects in my political life, which are Palestine and Iraq. On Palestine, I want to encourage you not to be fooled by this latest effort to throw sand in the eyes of the people. There is no roadmap. This roadmap is going nowhere except up a dead end. Except up a dead end. You know, President Arafat, with whom I've worked and marched for more than a quarter of a century, with whom I was under siege in Beirut, in the rubble, under the bombs, with whom I was under siege and bombed in Tunis, and with whom I have been under siege in Ramallah. I love him as a father, but he's wrong when he believes that this process can lead to a just solution to the Palestinian tragedy. As a matter of fact, I'm not even sure that he does believe that it's going to lead in that direction. Because what's happened in Palestine is that he, as the only elected leader in the whole of the Arab world, from the Atlantic to the Gulf, every puppet president, every corrupt king sits on their chair by virtue of oppression of their people. Arafat is the only leader who was ever elected, and yet he's been regime changed. They've invented, the Americans and the Israelis have invented a new position called Prime Minister. There is no such position as Prime Minister in the Palestine National Authority. Now, America and Sharon didn't invent this post because they wanted the Palestinians to have a better leadership. Why would Bush and Sharon want the Palestinians to have a better leadership? They invented this position because they wanted them to have a worse leadership, one that would get on their knees and surrender to them, one that would sign that which President Arafat refused to sign because the people would never have accepted it. And that's the process on which they're now engaged. They intend, indeed they openly boasted, that one of the effects of destroying Iraq would be to send such a shock wave through the Arab world, such a shiver of fear through the Arab regimes, that the whole Intifada and the whole of the Palestinian resistance would collapse, would be closed down, would be deported and expelled from the very few places who currently allow it to operate. They boasted that once the financial support coming from the regime in Baghdad to the families of the martyrs and the organizations struggling in the Intifada, once this was cut by the destruction of the Iraqi regime, that the Palestinian resistance would begin to melt away, as if these young men and women in Palestine are fighting for money. As if they're deciding to take their own lives, as if they're deciding to put on their uniforms and fight a military superpower for money, as if by cutting off dollars you can cut off the political lifeblood of such people, such heroes who for decades have confronted, like David facing Goliath, one of the mightiest armed forces on the globe. It is a preposterous idea. But the Intifada has not been defeated. Still less has it surrendered. And if this so-called Prime Minister attempts to sign a betrayal of the Palestinian national rights, of the people under occupation, and the millions of people living as refugees outside of Palestine, because the Palestinians are all one people with one address, and any attempt to divide them will be resisted. If this so-called Prime Minister attempts to sign such a surrender, such a betrayal, I believe that he too will be swept away by popular vote. So stand fast beside the Palestinians. Don't think they're on their way to a solution. They are not. This interlude will end soon. May even have ended this evening. Indeed, it hasn't even begun as an interlude. The Israelis are still surrounding every town and city in Palestine and occupying the vast majority of them. There are still thousands of Palestinian prisoners, the most important of whom, Marwan Barghouti, is being tortured this day in an Israeli dungeon. I spoke with his wife just a few days ago. He is still being brutally treated in the Israeli dungeons. And he is one of the real leaders of the Palestinian people. So don't be fooled, don't be misled, be steadfast, and be ready to support the Palestinian struggle in whatever form the Palestinians decide to take it. It's our duty to support them. It's their right to decide what form their struggle will take, and we have to give it our unconditional support. Now, turning to Iraq, there is no time for me to develop fully the sheer scale of the disaster, the blunder, the crime which our government and the United States government have committed in Iraq. We warned them over and over and over again in the long months leading up to this war. We told them that everything that they were claiming was false, would backfire, and would backfire against our own interests as well as representing a real crime against a people who had already grievously suffered. And let's look just briefly and quickly at the lies that they told. They told us that Iraq was brimful of weapons of mass destruction. Within 45 minutes, they said, chemical and biological missiles could land as far away as British bases on Cyprus. They never explained to us why we had British bases on Cyprus, by the way. Certainly not to defend Cyprus, which has been occupied by the Turkish army for more than 30 years. 45 minutes. Chemical and biological missiles that could go hundreds of kilometers. It was a bright, shining lie, and everybody in the country now knows it. They said that the Iraqis would welcome their invasion. This grotesque, racist fantasy that alone of all the people in the world, Iraqis were some breed of people who would welcome hundreds of thousands of foreign soldiers pouring into their country from land, sea and air, setting fire to their buildings, killing their young men and women, tying up their people in the streets with their face down in the dust and their hands tied behind their backs, raiding and ravaging their houses at every hour of the day and night, invading the privacy of their women, taking over their schools as military bases, building compounds in school yards, flying overhead with their helicopters and their jets, turning Iraq into a shawarma that they could carve up and hand out to their corporate friends. The idea that Iraq was supposed to welcome this, that the people were going to pour onto the streets and kiss the GIs and the British troops as they arrived, was a racist fantasy which from the very first day of the invasion has been disproved. We told them that the Iraqis will resist your invasion, and when it has triumphed and occupied Baghdad, that will not be the beginning of the end, but the end of the beginning. We told them Iraqis are not less than the Palestinians who are resisting General Sharon every day. They're not less than the French resistance who tore the guts out of any Nazi occupation troop they could find on the streets of Paris and the great cities of France. Iraqis are not less than the Italian or the Greek or the Yugoslav partisans who fought foreign occupation. The Iraqis are not less than we would have been if Hitler had crossed the Channel in 1941 when we stood alone, when the Americans were watching the war on newsreel, waiting to see if Japan attacked them before they joined the war. Every person in this room, every person in Britain, except the collaborators and the traitors, would have fought German occupation
of Great Britain to the very best of their ability. That's all the Iraqis are doing. That's all they're doing. And the very idea that you can describe somebody in their own country fighting against a foreign occupation army as a terrorist makes a mockery of the English language. How can you be a terrorist in your own country fighting against a foreign occupation army? And that's why we say, and it's not because we hate the British army, it's the opposite. We don't believe our young men should be sent to stand in the deserts of the south of Iraq for the re-election of George W. Bush and the enrichment of his Republican Party friends. And it's because we don't want to see them kill anyone else, and we don't want to see anyone else killing them, that we say, bring the British army home from Iraq now, before any more of them lose their lives. And you know, we've been here before. As I look out at this fantastic audience today, people who come from different corners of what was once this great, huge British Empire. Once I came home, I told my Irish grandfather that my teacher had said that Britain had an empire so vast that on it the sun never set. And my grandfather answered, that's because God would never trust the British in the dark. We've been here before. We've been here before. Britain occupied all these parts of the globe and had to be kicked out of them by mass resistance and armed struggle. And it will happen all over again if we try to reinvent ourselves as an imperial power. The days of imperialism are dead and buried, and no one is going to accept foreign occupation and rule of their land without fighting back against it. But that's what we have now, a new imperialism. I like to tell the story written, Reverend, by the great Christian philosopher St. Augustine in his work, City of God, in which he writes of the encounter between Alexander the Great and a pirate captain on the high seas. Ordering the pirate to halt, Alexander demands, how dare you terrorize these waters as a pirate? And the pirate answers, how dare you terrorize the whole world? Because I have one ship, you may call me a pirate, while you with your great navy can call yourself an emperor and other men what you will. Isn't that the world we're living in today? These self-appointed emperors of the globe, sitting there at their summits in Evian, carving up the globe, calling other men pirates and terrorists and rogue states, and we're allowed to have weapons but you can't have them because we've got a white face and you've got a dark face because we're Christians and you're something else. And that's why I say, until we change the prevailing social and economic system that rules the globe, we will be faced with endless wars. Our children, their children, their children will be sitting in halls like this opposing whatever the latest war is. Because war flows ineluctably from the system which they preside over, which requires injustice, requires domination, requires exploitation one by the other, requires them to conquer endlessly lands and markets and raw materials and commodities. The four Arab countries they now occupy physically, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Qatar, have underneath their sands 550 years of oil and gas. You don't have to be Einstein to work out why they're there. We've got 7 years of oil left in Britain. America has 25. These four countries have 550 years of oil. But the system of empire, of imperialism, the ruling economic and political system in the world is what has to be changed. And that brings me to my last point. Our great Stop the War coalition, which has united the Muslims, other believers, the left, the peace movement, the trade unions, the youth, the mightiest coalition the country has ever seen. More than 2 million people, many of you included, marched through London on February the 15th under the slogan, "Don't attack Iraq, freedom for Palestine." In Britain, in London, freedom for Palestine. 2 million people. And that coalition is not going away. We marched all these people up to the top of the hill, and we're not going to march them down again until we've changed conditions in this country for good and for the better. We're not going away. And let me say, for the avoidance of any doubt, I have never been in Iran. I have never met an Iranian leader. I don't even like the regime in Tehran. But if George Bush invades Iran, I'll be standing with Iran, and so should you, and so will the anti-war movement in this country. We've recalled the People's Assembly on the 30th of August. Elect delegates here from your communities to come to London and join with thousands of others at the length and breadth of the country who will be putting Tony Blair on trial in front of a people's tribunal on the 30th of August on the issue of weapons of mass destruction. Book your coaches now for the mighty demonstration that will take place in London on the 27th of September against the occupation of Afghanistan, Palestine and Iraq, and against any new war against Syria, Iran or anyone else. 27th of September, the eve of the Labour Party conference. We must make it so mighty a demonstration that it quite spoils Mr. Blair's weekend if he's still the leader of the Labour Party by then. And we're making a big effort to send as many people from here as we can to the Cairo conference, which will take place at the end of October in Cairo, which attempts to be a bridge between East and West, between the Muslim Arab world and the rest, which attempts to strengthen the anti-war, the anti-globalization, the anti-imperialist forces in the Arab world against their own regimes, these puppet presidents and these corrupt kings. And you can send delegates to that. Ibrahim, I've outstayed my welcome. I'm so grateful to you for this great meeting. I loved the restaurant that we were in. The food was not only fantastic, the mango lassi, but they even had the hubble bubble to smoke. It's a wonderful place. I recommend it to you. I'll certainly be back in Leicester. I hope not to stand for Parliament here, because I'm hoping to stand in Glasgow where I belong, but it's a very kind offer, and I close on that very last point. I don't know if the Labour Party will reinstate me or not. This is a matter for them. But whether in the Labour Party or out of the Labour Party, in Parliament or out of Parliament, as long as God gives me breath in my body, I'll continue to fight for the causes that we share. Thank you very much indeed.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وعلى آل محمد كما صليت على إبراهيم وعلى إبراهيم إنك حميد مجيد اللهم ربنا اغفر لنا ولإخواننا الذين سبقونا بالإيمان ولا تجعل في قلوبنا غلا للذين آمنوا ربنا إنك رؤوف رحيم اللهم ربنا اصرف عنا عذاب جهنم إن عذابها كان غراما إنها ساءت مستقرا ومقاما اللهم احفظ الإسلام والمسلمين اللهم احفظ بلاد المسلمين اللهم احفظ الحرمين الشريفين اللهم احفظ الأقصى الذي باركت حوله اللهم انصر الإسلام والمسلمين اللهم انصر من نصر دين محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم اللهم اجعلنا منهم اللهم اخذ من خذل دين محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم اللهم لا تجعلنا معهم ربنا آتنا في الدنيا حسنة وفي الآخرة حسنة وقنا عذاب النار ربنا لا تزغ قلوبنا بعد إذ هديتنا وهب لنا من لدنك رحمة إنك أنت الوهاب صلى الله تعالى على خير خلقه محمد وآله وصحبه أجمعين.